When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to the New Books Network Climate Psychology Alliance of North America podcast on climate change. The channel is Psychology and Climate Change. My name is C.K. Westbrook. Today I am serving as a co-host of the New Book Network's New Books in Psychology channel. My guest is actually the host of this podcast, Dr. Karen Messina. And I am C.K. Westbrook. I'm an environmentalist and author who lives and works in Washington, D.C. I'm the author of a science fiction series called The Impact Series, which includes The Shooting, The Collision, and The Judgment, with a fourth book, The Aftermath, being published in September. My books cover many issues, including gun violence, space debris, Kessler syndrome, and how we are polluting the environment on Earth and in space, personal responsibility, sexism and misogyny, and many other topics. I love weaving real-world topics and crisis into suspenseful science fiction. I also have a BA from Florida International University and a master's in environmental and natural resource policy from George Washington University. But let's get to talking about the book that we are going to talk about today. So before introducing Karen Messina, I'm going to tell you about this fantastic book. If you left the movie Barbie thinking profoundly about the doll's impacts on women, as well as sexism, misogyny, and patriarchy, then you will enjoy Barbie and the Great American Identity Crisis: The Sad Truth About a Land Fraught with Racism, Patriarchy, and Glaring Hypocrisy. The book does a deep dive into the issues broached in the film, including how, like Barbie, Americans are having intense identity crises and how it's affecting the world. Referencing historical events, environmental crisis, and other popular movies, Dr. Karen Messina makes a clear case of how pervasive and damaging patriarchy and dishonest identity crises are to women and men. And she creatively puts Barbie on the couch for analytic therapy. She explains how America will continue to suffer from an identity crisis and repeat the same mistakes, like celebration of greed and the cruel exploitation of people, nature, and animals for selfish reasons until Americans realize they should follow the path of truth and accepting responsibility for wrongdoing. That's a direct, great quote from the book. I love this book, which, like the Barbie movie, is thought-provoking, educational, and engaging. Now, let me introduce the author of this amazing book. Dr. Karen Messina is a psychologist and a child, adolescent, and adult psychoanalyst. In addition to maintaining a full-time private practice in Chevy Chase, Maryland, she's on the medical board of Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, which is part of Johns Hopkins Medicine. She's a podcast host for the New Books Network and chair of the Department of Psychoanalytic Education, DPE Scholarship and Writing Section, which is part of the American Psychoanalytic Association, APSA. She's a member of the AI Council of APSA, and she has also written and edited 6 books. Her topics focus on applying psychoanalytic ideas to real-world issues we all face in our complex world. And I just want to mention some of her other books because they are awesome as well. Misogyny, Projective Identification and Mentalization, Psychoanalytic Social and Institutional Manifestations was published in 2019. Aftermath, Healing from the Trump Presidency, 2020. Resurgence of Global Populism, A Psychoanalytic Study of Blame Shifting and the Corruption of Democracy was published in 2022. It's not me, it's you. How narcissists use projective identification to get what they want and how to stop them, published in 2023. A psychoanalytic study of political leadership in the United States and Russia in search of evidence, 2024. And now, Barbie and the Great American Identity Crisis in 2024. I've read most of her books and they are incredible and informative and thought-provoking as well. And I think we are ready to jump into questions, unless Dr. Messina, you would like to say something first.
Oh, that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Okay. In your book, Barbie and the Great American Identity Crisis, you imagine Barbie as a patient in psychoanalysis. Can you talk about the decision to do this? What were you hoping to illustrate?
Well, I think the formation of identity is one of the most important things that happens to a person psychologically. So I wanted to illustrate how important it is to be able to have a positive sense of self, to have self-respect, to know what's important to a person, to have a clear set of values and beliefs that are their own, not somebody else's. And this can be achieved in psychoanalysis. So I created this allegory as if Barbie were a real person so that I could illustrate what can happen in an analysis. So I sort of called it a snippet of an analysis. On the other hand, if a person doesn't have a strong sense of identity, or if it's been taken away from him or her for some reason, then there are a lot of negative things that can happen. A person can become quite depressed, despondent, anxious, and lose their purpose in life, or in some cases, they've never found it. And that's not psychologically a good place to be in. So that's why I wanted to do it. And I, again, use Barbie because she actually, a lot of people might not know this, she lost her identity. Barbie existed as another doll previously. She was made in Germany by a toy company, and her name was Lily, and she had quite a personality. She was a very sassy, bold woman who got what she wanted. It's even been said by many people that she was a sex worker. But anyway, she was a doll who was made by men, and she was for men. Children were not allowed to play with her. It was something that men gave each other at bachelor parties, and this Lily doll was available in tobacco shops, places like that in Germany. So why this was created, I'm not really sure, but Barbie previously had an identity. Ruth Handler and her daughter happened to be in Switzerland on a vacation, and they saw this doll. Ruth Handel had wanted to make a full figure doll, and she was turned down by the male executives at Mattel. So a couple of years later, she was on vacation. She saw this doll in the Swiss Alps. She brought it back, and she made very few changes. If you put them side by side, they look like twins. Anyway, so Lily, with quite an identity, was turned into Barbie, who really didn't have an identity. So that's when it came to me that this would be a good illustration of the importance of an identity.
Yes, that is totally awesome. And I should say, in your book, you go through the history, the true history of this incredibly popular billion-dollar toy that every single American, probably worldwide as well, is familiar with. And there is this complicated history, and it's riveting the way you write about it. And I will say too, for people who maybe have not seen the Barbie movie, or it's been a while, Barbie has an identity crisis in the movie because somebody is playing with her and having deep, dark thoughts. And in the movie, it's kind of represented by her feet going flat and she starts to have thoughts of death. And it's like, so she's having an identity crisis in the movie. So you just took that one step further and said, okay, what if she had this full-on identity crisis? Because you know, like you said, they kind of made up a story for the Barbie and ignored her past. which is kind of like ties into the identity crisis you discuss in America and the other chapters, where it's kind of like, in some ways, we've ignored some of our past and it's kind of backing up on us. So maybe we're all getting flat feet and paranoid thoughts because it's kind of a conflict. So can you discuss that a little bit, like where the identity crisis of Barbie is overlapping in similarity with the identity crisis of Americans?
Well, sure. I'll start with the Mattel Corporation. So they're a billion-dollar corporation. And to a large extent, it's due to the success of Barbie. Barbie was stolen from a German toy company. And the specific person who made Barbie was, he died brokenhearted. He was very confused, and he didn't understand what happened to his Lily. And there were court cases over the years, and eventually the whole thing was dropped, but it wasn't Mattel's idea. So they make all this money, and in a way, it's the idea of neoliberalism, which is fundamentally the rich get richer and the poor either stay the same or get poorer. So if you don't have any food for your children, if you don't have clothes for your children, you can't feel too good about yourself or have much of an identity. So that's one example of where, the movie and the Barbie story fit together with the American economy and this idea of deregulation and big corporations doing whatever they want to do to the common person, the middle class person, or the underserved people, unhoused people. So again, the rich get richer and the poor get more poor. I don't know if that touches on your question, but that's one answer.
Absolutely, yes. Because the movie was just had so many things going on, and your book really does a great job of pulling all of them in and then doing a deeper dive into them. So one of the things too was when people see Barbie, like a lot of us have a conflicting feelings, right? As a little girl, you're like, oh, look how beautiful she is. I'm not that beautiful. It some people hate Barbie because it says it does a job on girls' confidence and their unreasonable and unrealistic expectations of what women are supposed to look like and little girls are supposed to look like. But then other people just love it and accept it as just a doll that's a toy. And you talk about like Ken's role, like how sexism and what's the word, patriarchy, like that's a huge element in the movie and how patriarchy shifts. So can you talk a little bit about like where you saw the patriarchy in the movie and then how you elaborate on it in the book, as well as some of the issues with Barbie having been so beautiful and unreasonable expectations for little girls, which might affect their identity?
Well, I'll start with Ruth Handler's idea, or at least what she said publicly, is that she wanted little girls or women, little girls, to be anything they wanted to be. And by projecting their ideas, their fantasies onto Barbie, they could do that because they could make Barbie into anybody that they chose to make her into. The problem is, from a psychological perspective, identification doesn't work that way. People learn about themselves and how to navigate in the world from other people. So children early on identify with their parents, and parents see a behavior in a child and mirror back through eye contact what they think the child is experiencing. For example, if a child is in distress, you might see mom with big sad eyes as if to say it. You might say, oh, sweetie, what's wrong? So that the baby has a sense that the mom knows what's going on and understands him or her. Or you see pictures of babies who are delighted. I have lots of pictures of happy children and their mothers reflecting happiness in their eyes back to their children. So basically, the child feels understood. So feeling understood is really very important. And that is what goes into forming an identity. So it's an identification with other people. Oh, she gets me. I understand. This feeling is, I feel good. They don't have words yet. I'm happy. Oh, mom sees that. Oh, I understand. So it's just like having a mirror that is given to one person and then the other. You have to have these early experiences in order to form an identity. So the doll concept of projecting ideas onto a doll when you're 5 or 6, it really doesn't make any sense. You have to have interactions with real people. So that's part of the problem. The whole Ken phenomenon in the movie is very interesting. But I mean, because the Kens kind of were, they were arm candies. They switch roles. So the typical female role where a woman has traditionally, sometimes today too, not so much maybe, but still, obviously this exists. It's still a patriarchal world. It's reversed. So the Kens are the arm candy, so to speak. Well, obviously for one sex or the other to have all the power, it doesn't work. And that kind of comes out as the movie unfolds. And previously, I've done slideshows about patriarchy. And one thing that I've said is that if men can't have love, the next best thing is power. And I really do think that's part of what drives patriarchy. Women, as a whole, not all, but women are more prone to share among their girlfriends, say, if they're sad or if they've broken up or if somebody's left them. They talk about it, which is, of course, very powerful and very good. But men, and I think the manosphere on the web would probably back this up. Men don't do that. They talk to each other on the manosphere or whoever wants to listen. But traditionally, they don't sit around in groups and, you know, cry with other men. They man up and they look for power and they grab it. So I do think that that's what's happening. It happens a lot in our world. And the manosphere is a whole other thing of men who don't like women. And it's really, I mean, the internet is pretty scary in that regard.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and it also, like, in the movie, right, they show the clear example of the flip. The arm candy. And, you know, women have always been the arm candy in movie, right? From 007 to, I think you mentioned American Beauty. So these ingrained patriarchy is so deep. Like, sometimes I don't even notice it until it's like pointed out, oh, like the movie, I don't know if you saw Oppenheimer last summer, which was kind of competed with Barbie. Like, they both were like these $1 billion movies. If you saw Oppenheimer, there was only two women in the movie. One was naked half the time. The other one was drunk half the time, even though they were brilliant women and told that they were brilliant women, but that was the roles. I found that incredibly frustrating. Then I go and watch Barbie, here it is. And it's like, it was just kind of like, and I know Oppenheimer were supposed to be in the 40s. So, you know, they did a really good job of showing how sexist things were. And then of course it even went into the future because we all know that Ryan Gosling, Ken, got nominated for an Academy Award, but the women who created, wrote, and basically made this phenomenon. I mean, Barbie was a $1 billion movie, didn't get the recognition that they deserve. So it's still alive and well. But your book is so good too about the layers of how much patriarchy hurts women and men. And that when everybody like buys into the way things are, it's just really damaging. So, and you kind of touch a little bit on the social, the world we're living in now, like with Trump, you've written books about that, and we might be going into it. Like, it's kind of like patriarchy is back in style almost on steroids. Do you like agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And it's really a shame because nobody really benefits from that. Equality is where we really want to go. And yet it looked like we were getting closer, at least to me it did, a number of administrations ago in the past. But during the Obama years, it felt much better to me. But it's certainly, there's obviously a major backslide. And I mean, I don't want to get too off topic, but the 2024 election has a lot of people are very frightened by that. I mean, I hear that every day in my private practice and just with people I talk to all the time. So there's a lot of anxiety about that we could even become more of a patriarchal country, society, world, possibly.
I totally, and again, with the Barbie book, like the, last summer, I feel like we were somewhat feeling a little hopeful, or when the movie came out, and then, you know, Roe v. Wade was overturned, and we've just had a true backlash. Like, it's, or whiplash almost, right? One step forward, huge tug backwards. And I would just like to say, it has been reported that in recent years, there has been an unprecedented rise in the need for mental health practitioners and support. What can be done to make therapy more accessible and acceptable to people? And how can we break the stigma of mental health care being perceived as weak or shameful? And again, I'm going back to your book because you talk a lot about how misogyny and patriarchy hurts men until they can express their emotions, and then women and society accepts this, we're kind of stuck in this cycle of like harming each other, being men and women. So how do you think expansion of therapy to more people would help that situation?
I think money needs to be made available. In terms of the country, at the state level, at the local level, so more mental health facilities can be created, built, people hired to help people. All of the therapists I know, I when people ask me for referrals, I'm at a loss because everybody has taken on more people than they ever have before. So, I mean, just having more therapists, yes, that is needed, but how does this all come about? And I think, I mean, there are a lot of very good community clinics, or there could be, where people could get services, but they don't exist. So it's making more, it's spending more money to have mental health available to more people. And I think the pandemic, it was my experience anyway, and the experience of a lot of my colleagues, that it really ramped up the need for more therapists and therapy, because people were together. They were together a lot. Being together is good, but sometimes when you're together all the time, it's very, very difficult. So in this part of the country, and I wouldn't have said this a few years ago, I think there's less of a stigma about therapy. I think when people are in therapy, if they talk about it to other people, not their therapy, but the idea of therapy, I think that's helpful. And it can be particularly helpful if men talk about their therapist. I have a lot of male patients, and at least in this part of the country, there isn't as much of a stigma as there was previously. But I think if people write about their experiences, therapists and people who have gone through therapy and talk about it, write and talk about the positive experiences they've had and the benefits, I think that can help.
Yeah, absolutely. We need more therapists available. Another issue that you discuss in the book is that contributes to the American identity crisis is the fact that we haven't really confronted the tribal genocide, the history of enslaved people, the history of even modern history since the 1950s with tribes and the African American and low income communities. We kind of created like a fake identity, right? We're the heroes after World War II, 1950s. Americans are the greatest, and we just kind of like erased everything. And that's kind of crumbling down in society. In the book, you use the term blame shifting in your work to help explain the effects of projective identification. What is projective identification and how can people look out for it? And do you see that tied into our like kind of reworking our history?
Absolutely. Projective identification, and I do call it blame shifting because it's easier to remember that. And I think I've even seen world leaders use blame shifting, that and specific term. So it's getting out there a little bit. But projective identification, you know, aka blame shifting, is when somebody has a trait. It could be a country, it could be a person. Mainly I talk about people, but I have also talked about this happening in countries. They have a trait, a characteristic that they don't like about themselves. Now, this is unconscious when it's projective identification, but it's easier to put it on somebody else. And then they're the carrier of this bad characteristic. One example that I think is helpful is that, say, take a man or a woman. I'll say the person's name is Joe. Joe's at work, and Joe has, it's a day for his evaluation, and he gets evaluated by his boss, and his boss says, hey, listen, Joe, you're not cutting it here. This isn't working out. We may have to put you on a PIP, a performance improvement plan. Your work isn't getting done on time. You're not supervising your staff. People are, they don't have a sense of direction. So you've got to clean up this act here, or this isn't working out. This job isn't going to work out. And look at this office. I mean, all you have to do is look in the office. And I mean, it just feels like disorganization is permeating this place. So we're going to have a talk in 6 weeks just to see if you've made any progress. So Joe, realizing that, now this could be Eileen. Joe just came to my mind. So Joe is upset, but he, like most people, know that it's better not to argue with the boss, because obviously Joe's tenure at the company could end immediately if he were to do that. But he's really mad. He doesn't really think it's fair. He doesn't think the guy was on track. He thinks he does all of these things for the company, and he thinks he's a good employee. So he goes home, and the first thing he does, he comes in, he's mad. Now, he doesn't talk about his feelings with his partner. That would be good if he could say, you know, something really, really upsetting happened to me today. That would be a good way to go. But instead, he says, look at this place. This is a mess. This house is, when is the last time these kids have had a bath? I mean, look at the kitchen. It's a disaster. Now, Mary is stunned. I mean, she's been working all day remotely at home, taking care of the kids, making dinner. I know this is a stereotype of it, but we could flip it. You know, Joe could be home doing the same thing. And Mary could be the one who is chewed out by the boss. But anyway, since I've started down this path, Joe and Mary. So Mary's stunned. She doesn't really know what hit her. It's just like she thought her day was going along pretty well. She was managing a lot of things, juggling, so to speak. And it was working out. And now she gets slammed with all this. Well, this isn't about Mary. This is about Joe. But Joe doesn't like being accused of not being a good employee. So he projects this onto Mary. Now, the person, the recipient, it happens all the time. It happens in daily life, in little ways and in big ways, all the time. If Mary feels, well, I think most people feel stunned, like, huh? I thought everything was going pretty well. If she catches it and says, now, Joe, wait a minute. We need to really look at this head on. Now, something must have happened to you today, because what you're accusing me of, that's not what happened. That's not my experience. So we need to talk about it. That's giving the projection back. But that doesn't happen most often, at least until someone learns how to do that. Usually they feel stunned. And if they have a poor self-concept, say their sense of identity is not well established, they can eventually start to believe that Joe is right, that they are a mess. They don't take care of their children. They didn't do a good job while they were working remotely. And the kitchen is a disaster. And then that, of course, affects somebody's self-concept. So it's projective identification, is that somebody projects something onto another person, and then the person identifies with the projection. So blame shifting is, it's more conscious. You kind of know you're doing it, but it's the same idea. I don't like this about myself, so I'm going to say you did it, not me.
Right. And it's in, if it happens in that, in your scenario, Mary loves that person, right? So, you know, you love your spouse or partner or your friends or whatever. So when they do that to you, that's going to be part of the reason you're taken aback, right? Because you're like, I trust this person in general, and makes it harder to, like you said, if you don't have a strong sense of identity and confidence in yourself, then it, and then of course that's going to spiral, probably make Mary do a worse job because now she's worried and she's got this extra stress added to all the other stress, right? So that doesn't make anything better. That happens all the time. And then in your book too, you kind of put it into the bigger concept of society, us versus them, right? We take traits from other groups and project on Democrats, on Republicans, on different colors, different sexuality. Like, so you use some examples in your book, I think with American Beauty, where like, it can culminate into violence.
It can culminate into violence. And I was going to mention also that this happens, this process happens a lot. This phenomenon, it's actually a defense mechanism. It happens a lot in cases of domestic violence where, and usually I believe it is statistically true that men are usually the perpetrators in domestic violence. Again, not always, but in most cases, they're just getting rid of something and they put it on their spouse, their girlfriend, their significant other, or maybe just somebody that they're dating. And instead of saying you're this and that and the other thing, they batter them and hit them, kick them, do all kinds of things. And it gets a lot worse from there. But it's coming from the person projected onto the victim. It does get ramped up and it does get physical. And that's really, obviously, that's very dangerous.
Yeah, and you have a lot of examples in your book about how it can get ramped up into violence. And frustrating, because as you say, a simple solution is to talk about your feelings and to like, you know, we could tone a lot of things down and people could just have conversations. But then that goes back to the stereotype of men and misogyny and toxic masculinity, where they're not allowed to talk about what their feelings are because society comes down on them so hard, which goes back again to Barbie when Ken has his like existential identity crisis at the end of the, and Barbie listens and they kind of come to a common agreement that they can work together and share power and share. It'd be amazing if that happened in the real world. Okay, but going back to your book too, you put Barbie on the couch, you analyze her past life, reconciling it with the identity that was created for marketing and money reasons, right? It happens all the time in society. This is an amazing example, like because it's Barbie. And then you put her into a future of where she would be more happy. And I just want to tie this to one of your specialties, which is climate change. Can you talk a little bit about eco grief and climate anxiety and what are some of the tools that people can employ to feel less anxious and grief stricken and more emboldened to make a difference? And can you tie climate change to Barbie and your book?
Yeah, so Barbie becomes, she gets her master's degree in this story. And she gets married, she has a child, and she becomes a spokesperson for climate change. And also she gets involved with AI too. But she becomes a champion of the climate crisis and goes all over the world. And since she's so well known, people listen to her because they know who she is. So that's one of the things that she does. She has a life. She has a very clear sense of identity after she finishes her analysis and becomes employed and very engrossed in the climate situation. Climate anxiety is very, it's very important. And again, it's important for people to talk about it, not just to kind of brush past it. I mean, if you think about a species that is no longer here, that's a very sad thing. And people can say, oh, yeah, they could read about it and say, oh, the XYZ butterfly is extinct now. Oh, yeah, that's terrible. And just keep moving. But it's important to really focus on that. I mean, this butterfly will never be seen again. One's children will never see it again, or never see it in the first place. So it's important, just like with any loss, it's very important to process it. And it's happening with so many, there's grief about so much. I mean, about wildlife, our disappearing forests, oceans, the polluted air. And it's going to be a very different planet for our children and our grandchildren. And that's something that people need to really pay attention to, no matter what party they're affiliated with. This climate change isn't some kind of fantasy. Those climate change they're facts. Global warming is based on facts, not anybody's idea about something. So I think people need to stay really informed about what's going on. They need to stay up to date on environmental issues without becoming too overwhelmed. Sometimes these things can be overwhelming. That's when it might be good to talk to a therapist or talk to somebody to process the feelings that one is having. And there's so many good books that are out there. For example, Heather White, she has a new book out. I purchased it. I haven't read it yet, but the last one was One Green Thing. And she's somebody who believes that it's not too late. There are people who think that the point of no return has been reached and passed, and we can't do anything about it. Those people, I believe, are called deep adaptationalists. They think it's too late. But many other scientists and other very well-informed people about the environment think it's not too late. So, One Green Thing is about different categories of people. There's a warrior and other categories, and this is leads to what one can do. Some people can do clean up bottles on beaches or in the ocean. Other people can work towards changing something at in their local level of their local county council level. Other people can do things in Congress, but there's something everybody can do. I think you may know the name of her new book. It's something that you can do in a period of time. You happen to know the new, I think you might know.
It is called 60 Days to a Greener Life, Ease Eco-Anxiety Through Joyful Daily Action. It's an excellent book. Like you're saying, it's like if you feel overwhelmed, it's just day one, go out in nature. Day two. So they get more complicated, some of them, but if you just follow the 60 days, you will feel like you are actually doing something to stop climate change and ease your own. And I love it that at the end there's a quick top 10. And there's things in there like I'm an environmentalist and I work on endangered species and wildlife and climate change. So I love both that you had Barbie using her fame for good in the book. And I love this Heather White's books are amazing and very inspiring because I mean, just feeling like the summer is coming, right? We should be all happy. Summer's coming. We're going to the beach. You know, days get a little bit slower at work. It's a good time. But my eco-anxiety revs up because I'm like fires and hurricanes and flooding and what's going to happen to so many people and animals. I'm kind of enjoying the spring. It's kind of like, I feel like it's the calm before the storm, because like, and you know, this is new, like only in the last 5 or 10 years, I feel like, do people actually feel their anxiety start to go up with seasons that we used to just enjoy. So books like this and taking actions, personal actions, are really important. Can I ask you one more question? Can we do one more question?
Absolutely. And then I have one more question for you. Yes.
Okay. So I was going to tie this to the area of political psychology is growing rapidly, because politics and the environment and everything are intertwined, and for the good or the bad. Can you talk a little about this field and explain more of what it entails? Why it is important that we talk about it? What did you become interested in the area of it? Why are you interested in this area of psychology?
Well, it's a thriving new field, as you're suggesting, and the roots are come from political science and psychology, and it does connect to a wide range of other social sciences, including sociology, for example, economics, communication, business, education, and many other fields. So it's an attempt to understand the psychological underpinnings of the consequences of political behavior. And obviously, we need to know about the consequences of political behavior, because we're right in the middle of some serious political behavior. So
that's adding to the anxiety this summer, right? It's like storms, hurricanes, election is coming. It's a very anxious time.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are really feeling it in, I think, a new way. It seems much more intense.
And I would also say everybody is feeling it, right? Like, how hot is it going to be? Are we going to lose our air conditioner, like half of Texas did last summer? You know, like it affects everyone's lives. Whereas I think in the past, like even like 5 or 10 years ago, it was mostly scientists or people that were engaged in the, you know, political world or conservation. But now everyone is in here.
Absolutely. I would like to ask you something that I think a lot of people don't think about. And I was in your trilogy. It was fascinating to read about space debris. And when I've had conversations with people about space debris, some very educated people, they look at me and say, is that old stuff that's still left in space? And I say, well, yeah, yes, that's more or less what it is. But I do know an expert who could really give you a very learned answer to it. So, if you could say a little bit.
So my series talks about pollution on Earth, but also the big thing is the space debris, and it causes a collision that causes problems for all human beings. But space debris is a huge problem. There are millions of pieces of garbage, basically pollution, leftover tool bags or dead satellites, or, you know, and it's just orbiting around in upper space, lower Earth orbit. But anyway, and when these things are moving at, you know, hundreds of miles per hour, and when one piece hits another piece, that can cause a collision. Then that piece hits another piece and another piece and another piece, and that's Kessler syndrome, which would just be catastrophic. It could take down all the satellites. It could take down the International Space Station, which moves all the time, because they find a projectile coming right at it, and it has been hit a few times. So we've kind of taken this irresponsibility that we would say, oh, the oceans are so big, we can never overpollute the oceans, right? Well, they're polluted with oil, they're polluted with plastic, they're polluted, fisheries are all collapsing, coral reefs are dying worldwide. So yes, you can pollute, the oceans are big and vast, but they can be polluted. Space, the same thing. The other day, a piece of space garbage came flinging down, went right through a person's house, during their roof in Florida. And everyone, plausible deniability, was like, well, it's not my piece. You know, you got to track it back and find out what satellite that came from, whatever. Well, how is a normal American supposed to even track when they get hit by space debris or space garbage? But NASA finally came and said, yes, it came from the International Space Station. So we will help rebuild your roof. And it just blows me away that there's this huge environmental crisis. There are space environmentalists. I met an astrophysicist the other day who calls herself a space environmentalist. Thank God we need them to start talking about and addressing this problem before it gets completely out of control. But you also have the CEOs and the leaders in the industry totally ignoring it, just like oil and gas ignores it, plastic pollution ignores it, agricultural pesticide ignores the fact that we're wiping out bees and other crucially important insects. So we got to be really careful with handing all this power to people that are rich, because over and over again, they've shown that they neglect things, they take advantage of it, and then it's the regular people, the planet, nature, animals that suffer the consequences. So yes, it's a really big problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked the question. I'm glad you answered it in such a thorough way, because I'm not sure people really think about that too often, using myself as an example. So thank you very much for that great explanation.
Sure. And I will say, I have a fourth book coming out in September, The Aftermath, which is kind of like my dreamy world of what the world is like if we all lived in a sustainable environmental way. So it takes place 5 years after the shooting. And it's just, I feel like it's an optimistic book for, it's dark still. I write science fiction. I write dark science fiction, but it's like, what could the world be like if we were actually really respectful and kind to each other and our planet and space?
Well, I think people need that. They need to know what a positive world where people work together, what that would look like, because more and more it's what is not seen, it's what's not happening. So,
and we need hope, because that's the only thing that counter depression, right?
Well, that's an important thing. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I feel like we talked a lot about the book, Barbie and the Great American Identity Crisis. It is so awesome. I love this book. I just read it, couldn't put it down. Amazing. Absolutely intriguing. I keep talking about it to all my friends. People did not know the history of Barbie. That's intriguing. I think that the speech, you know, the character America Ferrera's speech about what women have to do and how we still don't really, like, it's just difficult to be a woman in society, has always been. And she just kind of nailed it. And I just love that when I came out of that movie, I was thinking so many things. And then this book was like brilliant, because it allowed me to even deep dive into things I hadn't even thought about. So I highly, highly recommend this book for anyone who appreciated Barbie or any of these issues that we've been discussing. So do you want to talk about where people can get it? What the next, what your next plans are?
Well, they can definitely get it on Amazon. It's I discounted it, so it's available to people for 99 cents, the Kindle version, and then of course there's a paperback. And I also had an audio book made, so it will be on Audible soon. So a lot of people, more and more people, like to listen to books, so that will be available in the very near future. I think it's available at major bookstores, definitely Amazon, Barnes and Noble. I'm not sure about smaller ones, but they could probably get it for people.
And I think people should check out all your other books, because they are so good as well. And what about socials? You're on Instagram.
I also have a new website that lists all of these things, which is, it's different than my old one. It's Dr. Karen Messina.com. So it's DrKarenMessina.com.
Cool. So people can find out what's going on. As you move along, I'm sure you're going to be doing other podcasts. I have thoroughly enjoyed interviewing you on your podcast. This has been fantastic. And if you ever need me to do it again, I would love it. Do you have any last words or anything else that you want to say in conclusion?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you for doing this. This was a great experience to get on the other side of a podcast. I mean, I've done podcasts with other hosts, but you're among the best.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. This has been awesome.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And we'll talk again, perhaps after Aftermath comes out.
Oh, I would love that. Oh, and I would say too that www.ckwestbrook.com is my website, and it's got all the pre-order information and all the information about my other books.
Okay, sounds great. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.